This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, see LibriVox.blogzone.com. Today's reading by Hugh Blair. Situation was one in which all voluntary thought was swallowed up and lost. I was hurried away by fury, revenge alone, and dazzled with strength and composure, molded my feelings, and lavished calculated calm. From death portion. My first resolution was to quit Geneva forever, my country, which, when I was happy and beloved, was dear to me. Now, in my adversity, became hateful. I provided myself with the sum of money, together with a few jewels which had belonged to my mother, and departed. And now my wandering began, which are to cease but with life. I have traveled a vast portion of the earth and endured all the hardships which travelers in deserts and barbarous countries are wont to meet. How I have lived, I hardly know. How many times I stretched my failing limbs upon the sandy plain and prayed for death. But revenge kept me alive. Leave my adversary. When I quitted Geneva, my first labor was to gain some clue by which I might trace the steps of my future end. But my plan was unsettled, and I wandered many hours around the uncertain what path I should pursue. As night approached, I found myself at the entrance of the cemetery where William and Elizabeth, my father, reposed. I entered it and approached the tomb in which Martha lays. Everything was silent, except the leaves of the trees which were gently agitated by the wind. The night was nearly dark, and the scene would have been solemn and affecting even to a calm, interested observer. The spirits of the departed seemed to flit around like a cast shadow, which was felt but not seen around the head of the mourner. The deep grief which the scene had at first excited quickly gave way to rage and despair. They were dead, and I lived. Their murderer also lived, and to destroy him I must drag out my weary existence. I knelt on the grass and kissed the earth with quivering Stephen generally avoided thieves, as it was here that the population of the country was chiefly collected. In other places, human beings were seldom seen. Life generally subsisted on the wild animals that crossed my path. I had money with me and gained the friendship of the villagers while distributing. What I brought with me some food that I had killed, which after taking a small part, I always presented to those who were providing me with fire and utensils for cooking. My life, as it passed us, was indeed hateful to me. And in curing sleep alone, I could taste joy. Oh, blessed sleep. Often when most miserable, I sank to repose and my dreams lulled me. Spirits that guarded me divided me into moments, or rather powers of happiness that I know contain the strength to fulfill my pilgrimage. Deprived of this respite, I should have sunk under my hardships. During the day, I was sustained and inspirited by the hope of night. For in sleep, I saw my friends, my wife, and my beloved country. Again, I saw the benevolent countenance of my father, heard the silver tones of my Elizabeth's voice, and beheld Clerva enjoying health and youth. Often, when wearied by a toilsome march, I persuaded myself that I was dreaming until night should come, and that I should then enjoy reality in the arms of my dearest friends. What agonizing fondness did I feel for them? How did I cling to their fears, live? What agonizing fondness did I feel for them? How did I cling to their green forms that sometimes they haunted me in my waking hours, and persuade myself that they still lived? At such moments, vengeance, that burned within me, died in my heart, and I pursued my path towards the destruction of the kingdom, more as a task enjoined by heaven, as the mechanical impulse of some power of which I was unconscious, than as the ardent desire of my soul. What his feelings were when I pursued, I cannot know. Sometimes, indeed, he left marks in writing on the bark of the trees, cut in stone, that guided me and instigated my fury. My reign was not yet over. These words were legible. You live, and my power is complete. As I still pursued my journey to the northward, the snows thickened, and the cold increased in a degree almost too severe to support. The peasants were shut up in their hovels, and only a few of the most hardy ventured forth to seize the animals from the starvation and forced from their hiding places to seek for prey. The rivers were covered with ice, and no fish could be procured, and thus I was cut off from the chief article of nutrients. The triumph of my enemy increased with the difficulty of my labors. One inscription I had left was in these words: "Prepare your toils only to begin. Wrap yourself in furs and provide food, for you shall soon enter upon a journey where your sufferings will satisfy my everlasting hatred." My courage and perseverance were invigorated by these scoffing words. I resolved not to fail in my purpose, and calling on heaven to support me, I continued with unabated fervor to traverse immense deserts until the ocean appeared in the distance and formed the utmost boundary of the horizon. Oh, how unlike it was to the blue seasons of the south! Covered with ice, it was only to be distinguished from land by its superior wildness and ruggedness. The Greeks wept for joy when they beheld the Mediterranean and the hills of Asia, and hailed with rapture the boundary of their toils. I did not weep, but I knelt down, and with a full heart thanked my guiding spirits for conducting me in safety to the place where I hoped, notwithstanding my adversary's jibe, to meet and grapple with it. Some weeks before this period, I had procured a sled and dogs, and thus traversed the snows with inconceivable speed. I know not whether the fiend possessed the same advantages, but I found that, as before, I daily lost ground in the pursuit, and now gained it. So much so that when I first saw the ocean, he was but one day's journey in advance, and I hoped to intercept him before he should reach the beach. With new courage, therefore, I pressed on, and in 2 days arrived at the wretched hamlet on the seashore. I inquired of the inhabitants concerning the fiend and gained accurate information. A gigantic monster, they said, had arrived the night before, armed with a gun and many pistols, putting to flight the inhabitants of a solitary cottage through fear of his terrific appearance. draw, which he had seen from the numerous drove of trained dogs. He had harnessed them. In the same night, the joy of the horror-struck villagers had pursued his journey across the sea in a direction that led to nowhere. And they conjectured that he must speedily be destroyed by the breaking of the ice, frozen by the eternal frosts. On hearing this information, I suffered a temporary access of despair. He had escaped me, and I must commence a destructive and almost endless journey across the mountainous ice of the ocean, amidst cold that few of the inhabitants could long endure, in which I, the native of a genial and sunny climate, could not hope to survive. Yet at the idea that the fiend should live and be triumphant, my rage and vengeance returned, and like a mighty tide, overwhelmed every other feeling. After a slight repose, during which the spirits of the dead hovered round and instigated me to toil and revenge, I prepared for my journey. I exchanged my land sledge for one fashioned for the inequalities of the frozen ocean, and purchasing a plentiful stock of provisions, I departed from land. I cannot guess how many days have passed since then, but I have endured misery which nothing but the eternal sentiment of a just retribution burning within my heart could have enabled me to support. Immense and rugged mountains of ice often barred up my passage, and I often heard the thunder of the drowning sea, which threatened my destruction. But again the frost came and made the paths of the sea secure. By the quantity of provision which I had consumed, I should guess that I had passed 3 weeks in this journey, and the continual perfection of hope returning back upon the heart, often wrung, withered drops of despondency increased from my eyes. Despair had indeed almost secured my prey, and I should soon have sunk beneath this misery. Once, after the poor animal that conveyed me had with incredible toil gained the summit of a sloping ice mountain, and one, sinking under his fatigue, died, I viewed the expanse before me with anguish, when suddenly my eye caught a dark speck upon the dusky plain. I strained my sight to discover what it could be, and uttered a wild cry of ecstasy when I distinguished the sledge and the distorted proportions of the well-known form within it. Oh, with what burning gush did hope visit my heart! Warm tears filled my eyes, which I hastily wiped away, that they might not intercept the view I had of the demon. still my sight is dimmed by the burning drops and terror, giving way to the emotions that oppressed me, I wept aloud. But this was not the time to delay. I disencumbered the dogs of their guilty pain, gave them a plentiful portion of food, and after an hour's rest, which was absolutely necessary, and yet which was bitterly irksome to me, I continued my route. The sledge was still visible, nor did I again lose sight of it, except at the moment when, for a short time, some ice rock concealed it with its intervening crags. I indeed perceptibly gained on it, and when, after nearly 2 days' journey, I beheld my enemy no more than a mile distant, my heart bounded within me. But now, when I appeared almost within grasp of my foe, my hopes were suddenly extinguished, and I lost all trace of it more utterly than I had ever done before. A ground sea was heard, the thunder of its progress as the waters rolled and swelled beneath me became every moment more ominous and terrific. I pressed on, but in vain. The wind rose and the sea roared, and, as with the mighty shock of an earthquake, it split, cracked with a tremendous and overwhelming sound. The work was soon finished. In a few minutes, a tumultuous sea rolled between me and my enemy, and I was left drifting on a scattered piece of ice that was continually lessening, and thus preparing for me a hideous death. In this manner, many an appalling hour has passed. Several of my dogs died, and I myself was about to sink under the accumulation of distress when I saw your vessel rise at anchor, and holding forth to me hopes of successful in life. I had no conception that vessels ever came so far north, and was astounded at the sight. I quickly destroyed part of my sledge to construct oars, and by these means was enabled, with infinite fatigue, to move my ice raft in the direction of your ship. I had determined, if you were going southward, still to trust myself to the mercy of the seas rather than abandon my purpose. I hope to induce you to grant me a boat with which I can pursue my enemy. But your direction was northward. You put me on board before my dinner was exhausted, and I should soon have sunk under my multiplied hardships to a death which I still dread. My task is unfulfilled. Oh, when will my guiding spirit conduct me to the keeper and allow me the rest I so much desire? I must then die. I can yet live. If I do, swear to me, Walter, that you shall not escape, if you will seek me and satisfy my vengeance. And do I dare to ask you to undertake my pilgrimage to endure the hardships that If when I'm dead, the future will be dear. If the Ministry of the Vengeance should be nothing, you swear that he shall not live. Swear that he shall not triumph over my accumulated woes, to survive to add to the list of his dark crimes. He is eloquent and persuasive, and once his words had even power over my heart, but trust it not. His soul is as hellish as his form, full of treachery and fiend-like malice. Fear him not. All on him remains of William, Justine, Clara, Elizabeth, my father, and the wretched Victor, and to thrust your sword into his heart. I will hover near and direct the steel aright. Walton. Continuation. August 26th, 1770. You have read this strange and terrific story, Margaret. And do you not feel your blood congeal with horror, like that which even now pervades mine? Sometimes, seized with sudden agony, he could not continue his tale. At others, his voice broken, yet piercing, uttered with difficulty the words so replete with anguish. His fine and lovely eyes were now lighted up with a mediating indignation, now subdued to downcast sorrow, and quenched in infinite wretchedness. Sometimes he commanded his countenance and tones, and related the most horrible incidents with a tranquil voice, suppressing every mark of agitation. Then, like a volcano bursting forth, his face would suddenly change to an expression of the wildest rage, as he shrieked out imprecations on his persecutor. His tale was connected and told with an appearance of the simplest truth. Yet I own to you that the letters of Felix and Safi, which he showed me, and the apparition of the monster seen from my ship, brought to me a greater conviction of the truth of his narrative and its absurdities, however earnest and connected. Such a monster has, then, real existence, I cannot doubt. Yet I am lost in surprise and admiration. Sometimes I endeavor to gain from Frankenstein the particulars of this creature's formation, but on this point he is impenetrable. Are you mad, my friend, said he, or whither does your senseless curiosity lead you? Would you also create for yourself in the world a demoniacal enemy? Peace, peace. Learn my miseries and do not seek to increase your own. Frankenstein discovered that I made notes concerning his history. He asked to see them, and then himself corrected and augmented them in many places, but principally in giving me the life and spirit of the conversations he held with the dead. Since you have preserved my narration, said Thus has a week passed away, while I have listened to the strangest tale that ever imagination formed. My thoughts and every feeling of my soul have been drunk up by the interest of my guest, which this tale and his own elevated and gentle manners have created. I wish to soothe him, yet I can counsel one so indefinitely miserable. So destitute of every hope of consolation. Frankenstein discovered that I made notes concerning his history. He asked to see them, and then himself corrected and augmented them in many places, but principally giving the life and spirit to the conversation he held with his enemy. Since you have preserved my narration, said he, I would not that a mutilated one should go down to posterity. Thus has a week passed away while I have listened to the strangest tale that ever imagination formed. My thoughts and every feeling of my soul have been drunk up by the interest in my guest, which this tale and his own elevated gentle manners have created. I wish to soothe him, yet can I counsel one so infinitely miserable, so destitute of every hope of consolation to live? Oh no, the only joy that he can now know will be when he composes his shattered spirit to peace and death. Yet he enjoyed one comfort, the offspring of solitude and delirium. He believes that when in dreams he holds converse with his friends and derives from that communion consolation for his miseries or excitements to his vengeance, that they are not the creations of his fancy, but the beings themselves who visit from the regions of the remote world. This faith gives the solemnity to his reveries that render them to me almost as imposing and interesting as truth. Our conversations are not always confined to his own history and misfortunes. On every point of general literature, he displays unbounded knowledge and a quick and piercing comprehension. His eloquence is forcible and touching, nor can I hear him when he relates a pathetic incident or endeavors to move the passions of pity or love without tears. What a glorious creature must he have been in the days of his prosperity when he was thus noble and godlike in ruin. He seems to feel his own worth and the greatness of his fall. When younger, said he, I believed myself destined for some great enterprise. My feelings were profound, but I possessed a coolness of judgment that fitted me for illustrious achievements. This sentiment of worth was by nature supported me when others were depressed. For I deemed it criminal to throw away and use his grief for his talents that might be useful to my fellow creatures. When I reflected on the work I had completed no less than a lesser one than the creation of a sensitive and rational family. I could not drag myself with the herd of common projectors. But this thought, which supported me in the commencement of my career, now serves only to plunge me lower in the dust. All my speculations and hopes are as nothing left. Like the archangel who aspired to omnipotence, I'm chained to an eternal hell. My imagination is vivid, yet my powers of analysis and application are intense. By the union of these qualities, I conceived the idea and executed the creation of the man. Even now, I can recollect with what passion my reveries while the work was incomplete. I trod heaven with my thoughts, now exulting in my powers, now burning with the idea of their effects. From my infancy, I was imbued with high hopes and lofty ambition. But how I am sunk. Oh, my friend, if you had known me as I once was, you would not recognize me in this state of degradation. Despondency rarely visited my heart. A higher destiny seemed to bear me along until I fell, hoping never again to rise. Must I then lose this admirable being? I have longed for a friend. I have sought one who would sympathize with and love me. Behold, on these desert seas I have found such a one. But I fear I have gained him only to know his value and lose him. I would reconcile him to life, but he repulses the idea. I thank you, Walter, he said, for your kind intentions towards so miserable a wretch. But when you speak of new ties and fresh affections, think you that any can replace those who are gone? Can any man be to me as Clerval was, or any woman another Elizabeth? Even where the affections are not strongly moved by any superior excellence, the companions of our childhood always possess a certain power over our minds, which hardly any neighbor friend. They know our infinite disposition, which, however they may be afterwards modified or never eradicated, they can judge of our actions with more certain conclusions as to the integrity of their motives. A sister or brother can never, unless indeed such symptoms have been shown early, suspect the other of fraud or false dealings, when another friend, however strongly he may be attached, may, in spite of himself, be contemplated with suspicion. But my enjoyed friend, dear not only through habit and association, but from their own merits. And wherever I am, the soothing voice of my Elizabeth in the conversations of Clerval will ever be whispered in my ear. dear dad, did one feeling of such a solitude persuade me to preserve my life. If I were engaged in any high undertaking, the design, fraught with extensive utility to my fellow creatures, then I could live to fulfill what's up with my destiny. I must pursue and destroy the being to whom I gave existence. Then I walk the path will be fulfilled. September 2nd. My beloved sister, I write to you, encompassed by peril and ignorant whether I am ever doomed to see again dear England and the dear friends that inhabit it. I'm surrounded by mountains of ice which admit of no escape and threaten every moment to crush my vessel. The brave fellows who I have persuaded to be my look towards me for aid, but I have none to bestow. There is something terribly appalling in my situation, yet my courage and hopes do not desert me. Yet it is terrible to reflect that the lives of all these men are in danger truly. If we are lost, my mad, mad scheme is the cause. What, Margaret, will be the state of your mind? You will not hear of my destruction, and you will anxiously await my return. Years will pass in me without visiting of despair, and yet be tortured by hope. Oh, my beloved sister, the sickening failing of your heartfelt expectations is in prospect more terrible to me than my own death. But you have a husband and lovely children. You may be happy. Heaven bless you and make you so. My unfortunate guest regards me with the tenderest compassion. He endeavors to fill me with hope and talks as if life were a possession which he valued. He reminds me how often the same accidents have happened to other navigators who have attempted the sea, and in spite of myself, he fills me with cheerful auguries. Even the sailors feel the power of his eloquence. When he speaks, they no longer despair. He rouses their energies, and while they hear his voice, they believe these vast mountains of ice and molehills, which will vanish before the revolutions of men. These feelings are transitory. Each day of expectation delayed fills me with fear, and I almost dread a mutiny caused by this despair. September 5th. A scene has just passed of such uncommon interest that although it is highly probable that these papers may never reach you, yet I cannot forbear recording. We are still surrounded by mountains of ice, still in imminent danger of being crushed in their conflict. The cold is excessive, and many of my unfortunate comrades have already found a grave amidst the scene of desolation. Frankenstein has daily declined in health. A feverish fire still glimmers in his eyes, but he is exhausted, and when suddenly roused to any exertion, he speedily sinks again into a mentioned in my last letter the fears I entertained of a mutiny. This morning, as I sat watching the wan countenance of my friend, his eyes half closed and his limbs hanging listlessly, I was roused by half a dozen of the sailors who demanded admission to the cabin. They entered and their leader addressed me. He told me that he and his companions had been chosen by the other sailors to come in deputation to me to make a requisition, which in justice I could not refuse. We were near the ice, and could probably never escape, but they feared that if, as was possible, the ice should dissipate and a free passage be opened, I should be rash enough to continue my voyage and lead them into fresh dangers, after which they might happily have surmounted this. They insisted, therefore, that I should engage with a solemn promise that if the vessel should be freed, I would instantly direct my course southward. Their speech troubled me. I had not despaired, nor had I yet conceived the idea of returning if set free. Yet I could in justice, yet could I in justice, or even in possibility, refuse this demand? I hesitated before I answered. When Frankenstein, who had at first been silent and indeed appeared hardly to have force enough to attend, now roused himself. His eyes sparkled and his cheeks flushed with momentary vigor. Turning towards his men, he said, "What do you mean? What do you demand of your captain? Are you then so easily turned from your design? Did you not call this a glorious expedition? And wherefore was it glorious? Not because the way was smooth and placid as a southern sea, but because it was full of dangers and terror, because at every new incident, your fortitude was to be called forth, and your courage exhibited, because danger and death surrounded it, and these you were to brave and overcome. For this it was glorious, and for this it was an honorable undertaking. You were hereafter to be hailed as the benefactors of your species, your names adored as belonging to the brave men who encountered death for honor and the benefit of mankind. And now, behold, with the first imagination of danger, or, if you will, the first mighty and terrific trial of your courage, you shrink away and are content to be handed down as men who had not strength enough to endure cold and peril. And so poor souls grow chilly and return to their warm firesides. Why, that requires not this preparation. Ye need not have come thus far and dragged your captain to the shame of a defeat, merely to prove yourself cowards. Oh, be men, or be more than men. Be steady to your purposes and firm as a rock. This ice is not made of such stuff as your hearts may be. It is mutable and cannot withstand you. If you say that it shall not, do not return know not what it is to turn back. Turn their backs on the foe. He spoke this with a voice so modulated to the different feelings expressed in his speech, with an eye so full of lofty design and heroism, that can you wonder that these men were moved? They looked at one another and were unable to reply. I spoke. I told them to retire and consider what had been said, that I would not lead them farther north if they strenuously desired the contrary, but that I hoped that with reflection they had courage would return. They retired, and I turned towards my friend, but he was sunk in languor, and almost deprived of life. How all this would terminate, I know not, but I had rather die than return shamefully, my purpose unfulfilled. Yet I fear such would be my fate. The man, unsupported by ideas of glory and honor, can never willingly continue to endure their present hardship. September 7th, the die is cast. I have consented to return if we are not destroyed. Thus are my hopes blasted by cowardice and insincerity. Ignorant, disappointed. It requires more philosophy than I possess to bear this injustice with patience. September 12th. It is past. I am returning to England. I have lost my hopes of utility and glory. I have lost my friend. But I will endeavor to detail these bitter circumstances to you, my dear sister, and while I am walking towards England and towards you, I will not despond. September 9th, the ice began to move, and roarings like thunder were heard at a distance. As the island split and cracked in every direction, we were in the most imminent peril, but as we could only remain passive, my chief attention was occupied by my unfortunate guest, whose illness increased in such a degree that he was entirely confined to his bed. The ice cracked behind us and was driven with force towards the north. A breeze sprung from the west, and on the 11th, the passage towards the south became perfectly free. When the sailors saw this, and that their return to the native country was apparently assured, a shout of tumultuous joy broke from them, loud and long continued. Frankenstein, who was dozing, awoke and asked the cause of the tumult. They shout, they said, because they will soon return to England. Do you then really return? Alas, yes, I cannot withstand their demands. I cannot leave them unwillingly to danger. I must return. Do so if you will, but I will not. You may give up your purpose, but mine is assigned to me by heaven, and I fear not. I am weak, but surely the spirits who assist my vengeance will endow me with sufficient strength. Saying this, he endeavored to spring from the bed, but the exertion It was not long before he was restored, and after he thought that life was entirely extinct. At length he opened his eyes. He breathed with difficulty and was unable to speak. The surgeon gave him a composing draught and ordered us to leave him undisturbed. In the meantime, he told me that my friend would certainly not many hours to live. His sentence was pronounced, and I could only grieve and be patient. I sat by his bed watching him. His eyes were closed, and I thought he slept. But presently he called to me in a feeble voice, and bidding me come near, said, "Alas, the strength I relied on is gone. I feel that I soon shall die, and he, my enemy and persecutor, may still be doomed. Think not, Walton, that in the last moments of my existence, I feel that burnt hatred and ardent desire for vengeance expressed, but I feel myself justified in desiring the death of my mother's son. During these last days, I have been occupied in examining my past conduct, nor do I find it blameable. In a fit of enthusiastic madness, I created a rational creature and was bound towards him to ensure, as far as was in my power, his happiness and well-being. This was my duty. But there was another, still paramount to that. My duties towards the beings of my own species had greatly claimed my attention because they included a greater proportion of happiness or misery. Urged by this view, I refused, and did right in refusing, to create a companion for this creature. He showed unparalleled malignity and selfishness in evil. He destroyed my friends. He devoted to destruction beings who possessed exquisite sensations, happiness, and wisdom. Nor do I know where this thirst for vengeance may end. Miserable himself, that he may render no other wretched, he ought to die. The task of his destruction was mine, but I have failed. When actuated by selfish and vicious motives, I asked you to undertake my unfinished work, and I renew this request now. And I am only induced by reason and virtue." "Yet I cannot ask you to renounce your country and friends to fulfill this task. And now that you are returning to England, you will have little chance of meeting with him. But the consideration of these points, and the well-balancing of what you may esteem your duties, I leave to you. My judgment and ideas are already disturbed by the near approach of death. I dare not ask you to do what I think right, for I may still be misled by passion. But you should live to be an instrument of mischief disturbed nothing respects this hour, when I momentarily expect the release, the only happy one which I've enjoyed for several years. The forms of the beloved dead flit before me, hasten to their arms. Farewell, Walter. Seek happiness in the tranquility, and avoid ambition, even if it be only the apparently innocent form of distinguishing yourself in silence and discoveries. Yet why do I say this? I have myself been blasted from these hopes. Yet another may succeed. His voice became faint as he spoke, and at length, exhausted by his effort, he sunk into silence. About half an hour afterwards, he attempted again to speak, but was unable. He pressed my hand feebly, and his eyes closed forever, while the irradiation of a gentle smile passed away from his lips. Margaret, what comment can I make on the untimely extinction of this glorious spirit? What can I say that will enable you to understand the depth of my sorrow? All that I should express would be inadequate and feeble. My tears flow. My mind is overshadowed by a cold, a cloud of disappointment. But I journey towards England, and I may there find consolation. I am interrupted. What do these sounds portend? It is midnight, the breeze blows fairly, and the watch on deck scarcely stirs. Again, there is a sound as of a human voice, but hoarser. It comes from the cabin with the remains of Frankenstein still alive. I must arise and examine. Good night, my sister. Great God, what a scene has just taken place. I am yet dizzy with remembrance of it. I hardly know whether I shall have the power to detail it, yet the tale which I have recorded would be incomplete without this final and wonderful catastrophe. I entered the cabin where lay the remains of my ill-fated and admirable friend. Over him hung a form which I cannot find words to describe, gigantic in stature, yet uncouth and distorted in its proportions. As he hung over the coffin, his face was concealed by long locks of ragged hair, but one vast hand was extended in color and apparent texture like that of a mummy. When he heard the sound of my approach, he ceased to utter exclamations of grief and horror and sprung towards the window. Never before did I behold a vision so horrible as his face, of such loathsome yet appalling hideousness. I shut my eyes involuntarily and endeavored to recollect what were my duties with regard to this destroyer. I called on him to stay. He paused, looking on me with wonder, and again turning towards the lifeless form of his creator, he seemed to forget my presence, and every feature and gesture seemed instigated by the wildest rage of some uncontrollable passion. "That is also my victim," he exclaimed. in his murder my crime there consummated, the miserable series of my being's wound to its close. That is also my victim, he exclaimed, in his murder. Voice seemed self-educated, and my first impulses, which had suggested to me the duty of obeying the dying request of my friend in destroying his enemy, were now suspended by a mixture of curiosity and compassion. I approached this tremendous being. I dared not again raise my eyes to his face. There was something so scarring in my own feelings, ugliness. I attempted to speak, but the words died away on my lips. The monster continued to utter wild and incoherent self-reproaches. At length, I gathered resolution to address him in a pause of the tempest of compassion. Your repentance, I said, is now superfluous. If you had listened to the voice of conscience and heeded the strains of remorse before you had urged your diabolical vengeance to this extremity, Frankenstein would yet have lived. Do you dream? Said the demon. Do you think that I was then dead through agony and remorse? He continued, pointing to the corpse, he suffered not in the consummation of the deed. Portion of the anguish that was mine during the lingering detail of its execution. My frightful selfishness hurried me on, while my heart was poisoned with remorse. Think you that the groans of Clerval were music to my ears? My heart was fashioned to be susceptible of love and sympathy, and when wretched by the misery of vice and hatred, it did not endure the violence of the charred cage. Without torture such as you cannot even imagine. After the murder of Clerval, I returned to Switzerland, heartbroken and overcome. I pity Frankenstein, my pity amounted to horror. I abhorred myself. But when I discovered that he, the author at once of my existence and of its unspeakable torments, dared to hope for happiness, then while he accumulated wretchedness and despair upon me, he sought his own enjoyment in feelings and passions from the indulgence of which I was forever barred, then impotent. Envy and bitter indignation filled me with an insatiable I recollected my threat and resolved that it should be accomplished. I knew that I was preparing myself for the deadly torture, but I was the slave, not the master, of an impulse which I detested, yet I could not despair. Yes, when she died, nay, then I was not beautiful. I had cast off all feelings of futile anguish to riot in the excess of my despair. Evil thenceforth became my good. Urged thus far, I had no choice. Nature to an element which I had willingly chosen. The completion of my demonical design became an insatiable passion, and now it is ended. There is my last victim. I was at first touched by the expression of his misery. Yet when I called to mind what Frankenstein had said of his powers of eloquence and persuasion, and when I again cast my eyes on the lifeless form of my friend, indignation was rekindled within me. "Wretch," I said, "it is well that you come here to whine over the desolation made. You throw a torch into a pile of buildings, and when they are consumed, you sit among the ruins and lament the fall. Hypocritical fiend, if he whom you mourn still lived, still would he be the object, and yet would he become the prey of your accursed vengeance. It is not pity that you feel. You meant lament only because the victim of your malignity is withdrawn from your power. Oh, it is not thus, interrupted the demon. Yet such must be the impression conveyed to you by what appears to be the purport of my actions. Yet I seek not a fellow feeling in my misery. No sympathy will I ever find. When I first sought it, it was the love of virtue, the feelings of happiness and affection, with which my whole being overflowed, that I wished to be participated. But now that virtue has become to me a shadow, and that happiness and affection are converted to bitter and loathing despair, in what should I seek for sympathy? I am content to suffer alone. While my suffering shall endure, when I die, I am well satisfied with abhorrence and opprobrium should load my memory. Once my fancy was soothed with dreams of virtue, of fame, and of enjoyment. Once I falsely hoped to meet with beings who, pardoning my outward form, would love me for the excellent qualities which I was capable of unfolding. I was nourished with high thoughts of honor and devotion, but now crime has degraded me beneath the meanest animal. No guilt, no mischief, no malignity, no misery can be found comparable to mine. When I run over the frightful catalogue of my sins, I cannot believe vision of the beauty, the majesty of greatness. Ever grows, even so, the fallen angel becomes the roaming devil. Yet even that enemy of God, and man, and friends, and associates, is desolation. I am alone. You who call Frankenstein your friend seem to have a knowledge of my crimes and his misfortunes, but in the detail which he gave you, how then you could not sum up the hours and months of misery which I endured wasted in impotent passions. For while I destroyed his hopes, I did not satisfy my own desires. They were forever ardent and craving. Still, I desired love and fellowship, and I was still spurned. Was there no injustice in this? Am I to be thought the only criminal when all humankind sinned against me? Why do you not take Felix, who drove his friend from the door with contumely? Why do you not execrate the rustic who sought to destroy the savior of his child? Nay, these are virtuous and immaculate beings. I, the miserable and the abandoned, am an abortion to be spurned at, kicked, and trampled on. Even now my blood boils at the recollection of this injustice. But it is true that I am a wretch. I have murdered the lovely and the helpless. I have strangled the innocent as they slept and grasped to death his throat, who never injured me or any other living thing. I have devoted my creator, the select specimen of all that is worthy of love and admiration among men in misery. I have pursued him even to that irredeemable ruin. There he lies, white and cold in death. You hate me, but your abhorrence cannot equal which I regard myself. I look on the hands which executed the deed. I think of the heart in which the imagination of it was conceived, and long for the moment when these hands would meet my eyes, when that imagination will haunt my thoughts no more. Fear not that I shall be the instrument of future mischief. My work is nearly complete. Neither yours nor any man's death is needed to consummate the series of my deeds. In order to accomplish that which must be done, what it requires my life. Do not think that I shall be slow to perform this sacrifice. I shall quit the vessel on the ice raft which brought me thither, and shall seek the most northern extremity of the globe. I shall collect my funeral pile and consume to ashes this miserable frame. That it remains, its remains may afford no light to my curious and uncolored wretch who would the wind fan my cheeks. My feeling sense will pass away, and in this condition, must I find my happiness? Some years ago, when the images which this world affords first opened upon me, and I felt the chilling warmth of summer and heard the rustling of the leaves and the warbling of the birds, and these were all to me, I should have wept to die. Now it is only consolation. Born.